Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Skepticism and morality, and theology and the animal rights movement, two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with David Kopp of the University of California at Davis. Following that, a discussion with Andrew Lindsay of the Center for the Study of Theology at the University of Essex. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Kopp worked on a project about philosophy, reason, and needs. Here is David Kopp.
Well, I'm primarily interested in skepticism about morality, but modern philosophy has been oriented around skepticism, I think, since the time of Descartes, although, indeed, there were skeptics in the ancient world as well. Most of these skeptics in the ancient world were skeptical about everything, basically, about our having any knowledge at all of anything. Descartes was especially skeptical. At least he began his philosophy by thought experiments that led him to begin with skepticism about the external world, about other people, and so on.
Are we talking about what, trusting our perceptions of the physical world?
For Descartes, it was a matter of whether we could trust our perceptions of the physical world. He had this thought experiment. Suppose that the evil genius were to plug into your brain and make it seem to you that you were seeing a world consisting of people and tables and chairs and mountains and bricks and so on and so forth, when really, you know, you were just some sort of body on a table in the evil genius's laboratory. How would you know the difference? He thought that it'd be very, of course, very difficult to know that you weren't a body on a table in that circumstance. But then he asked the question, well, how do we know now, today, that we're not bodies on tables in an evil genius's laboratory? See? Yeah, so he was led to skepticism about the external world and to attempts to undermine skepticism about the external world with his famous I think, therefore I am, slogan, right, and arguments about the existence of God and whatnot.
You make me think of a story by Mark Twain called The Mysterious Stranger. The conclusion of the story proposes what? That we are all merely dreams, that it's all an illusion. The story is that Mark Twain didn't want to blame his fellow human creatures for what he saw as all this misery around him. He didn't want to blame whatever it is we call God. So he just took this third route and said it's all a dream. You know, we just sort of imagine these things. Does that have any consistency with this?
Well, that was another one of Descartes' thought experiments. He said, look, I mean, when we're dreaming, we seem to see a world around us, and we know that there isn't really, that what we're dreaming isn't really the case, that the dream is a false illusion of something that really isn't happening to us at the time, because of course we're asleep when we're dreaming.
Right.
So he said, "How, you know, now we seem to see a world around us. I seem to think that I'm in this little sound studio with Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, but maybe it's a horrible nightmare, and I'm, you know, just going to wake up tomorrow and I'll be, you know, safe in my bed and not in this sound studio.
Let's hope it's not a nightmare."
See, but this is skepticism of the Cartesian sort, which isn't specially oriented to morality. It's oriented to things that are much more difficult to doubt from a common sense point of view. But morality, doubts about morality, I think, in the modern secular world are much more commonsensical than Descartes' doubts about the external world and about other people.
Well, now, your angle on this relationship, David Kopp, between morality and skepticism, are we moving toward the using words like absolutes when we say that if there is a morality about which we need not be skeptical, if in fact that is what you are proposing, are we moving toward terms like the absolute? My sense here is that you philosophers tend to be very suspicious of that kind of language.
Well, we're not moving towards... The alternatives aren't skepticism or some sort of absolute morality. I'm not sure what absolute morality would be anyways, but But those aren't the alternatives. The alternatives are, I mean, what a skeptic would say would be something like, either morality is like a false theory, maybe it's like astrology, or morality is like some outmoded rule of etiquette, like maybe courtly love. Uh-huh. There's no objective basis to it at all. There's just self-interest. We just should pursue our self-interest. And this talk we hear about, you know, helping other people and so on, the skeptic would say, there's no objective basis to that. We should be more cold-blooded. We should be more concerned with ourselves and so on. We shouldn't let ourselves be misled by talk of our duty to other people. This is the sort of thing the skeptic would say, see? Uh-huh. And the alternative to that would be some view that would argue that there really is an objective basis to morality, and philosophers through history have tried to pin down some objective basis to morality, or some basis at least that would defeat this sort of skepticism. Contractarian theories, for example, that have been developed back in history by people like Hobbes and in the contemporary world by a philosopher named David Gauthier and others. Contractarian theories argue that, see, when you get rational people in a group, each of them trying to maximize their own interests, that they will see that their interests lie in agreeing among themselves to restraining their individual selfish behavior in order to cooperate together and thereby enlarge the size of the pie, so to speak, so there's more pie to divide up.
And then you come to something like William Golding and Lord of the Flies, and you get back to, what do you want to call it, fallen human nature. You believe in original sin, that people simply aren't going to act that way in one another's interest as consistently as you would hope, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, you don't want to be distracted by the fact that people don't always act morally. Of course, people don't always act morally, but that's not really anything that gives the skeptics doubt much power, because everybody will agree that there's going to be problems motivating people to act morally. There are people who are irrational. There are people who don't see their interests. There are people who don't want to help other people, and so on. So there's always going to be people who are irrational. There's always going to be people who are immoral.
Well, then what
that's
is the
not
basis?
That's not the issue.
The issue is
whether it's possible to connect up morality with rationality or with the bases of our other kinds of knowledge in such a way as to show a kind of basis to morality that we can find firm enough to trust. And what I'm trying to explore is this idea. I think it's an intuitive idea that morality finds its basis in the fact that societies need there to be certain rules that people subscribe to and follow, at least by and large subscribe to and follow, because otherwise they would fail. Otherwise there wouldn't be cooperation. Otherwise people wouldn't get together to accomplish their larger aims in life. Not even the police can operate. I mean, you can't just operate a society on the basis of coercion. Even the police force and even the law requires there to be a kind of background commitment on the part of the people to generally complying with these rules. So we've got to have, and this is the basic intuition, we've got to have in a society some acceptance of rules that are going to be the basis of our common life. But we know that moralities are taught. We know that how we learn about morality. And I'm not saying anything extraordinary along those lines. I mean, I'm just relying on what the psychologists tell us about how people learn morality. The issue, mm-hmm. though, is whether what we're teaching people when we teach them morality is something arbitrary or whether it has some kind of basis. And my claim is that its basis is in the needs of our common life.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, David Kopp. What might be some of the components of this, what, common morality that you are, that leads to yet a second question by way of conclusion here. Are you being descriptive or proscriptive? Are you setting forth, moral standards, or are you simply standing back and saying this is what's worked and we ought to consider including this in this morality equation here?
Well, both at the same time, really. I don't think you can separate things in that way. I think to some degree, one of the things that modern philosophy has realized is that the distinction be not so clear-cut. Even in science, there are certain standards of evaluation that are evaluative standards that have to be used by any scientist in evaluating theories and in deciding which theories to accept rather than others. So there's no real clear-cut distinction between evaluative enterprises and descriptive enterprises. But so the enterprise I'm involved in is a combination, and it involves really trying to propose standards for evaluating moral codes, so that what I'm trying to do is analogous. What I'm trying to do in relation to morality is analogous to what you might think of a philosopher trying to do in thinking about science. So someone thinking about science will say, well, you know, what are the standards that we should use in looking at these different scientific theories? You know, we have quantum mechanics, Newtonian mechanics. What do? We have these different theories. Which is the best theory? The skeptic's view about morality, to use this analogy again, would be analogous to a skeptical view about science. The skeptical view about what science would say something like, well, you know, there are no standards to use in evaluating scientific theories, or no standards that have any cogency. You know, some people like one theory, other people like another. It's just a matter of opinion, sort of arbitrary choice. Yeah. You know, some people say they like this theory because it's simpler, but, you know, someone else might like complex theories, you know. Well, in morality, the skeptic says something analogous, you know.
Yeah. Footnote to our conversation, David Kopp, are you a skeptic? What is
morality?
It? Yeah, no. What is it that brought you, that makes you passionate and interested in a topic like this, that would, you know, you want to devote a couple of years of your life writing a book about this? I mean, is it
than a couple of years, I hate to say.
what kind of a personal dimension enters in there?
Well, you know, I think that skepticism about morality actually is pretty common in our secular society. And I am bothered by that fact, because the skeptics that you meet sort of at cocktail parties, who raise their eyebrows when you say that you're a philosopher interested in morality, these people are not, I mean, carry certain problems with, these view carry certain problems with it for society, their view carries problems for society, because it goes along with the attitude that you find in politics, for example, that moral dimensions to decision making are soft and emotional, that they really oughtn't to be given credence. This attitude goes along with the sort of attitude that we supposedly see, amongst many people who are involved in investment banking and whatnot, you know,
sure,
that we're supposed to be appalled by, you know,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, these people are supposed to be out for their own interests, you know, for the bigger BMW and not for the greater social good. And this is sort of part of the culture now, and it worries me, and it seems to me that the philosopher ought to look at the culture and to try to deal with the problems that he sees around him in the culture. And this is one of the problems, I think. And you know, when I tried to figure out how, as a philosopher, I could answer skepticism, and began to think about the various traditional answers that philosophers have given from the days of Plato and Aristotle through the days of Kant and so on, I frankly had to concede that the philosopher's answers really were not adequate. And so I began to think that if I was going to take this problem seriously, I'd have to try to come up with an answer of my own. Now, of course, nobody will probably believe my answer, but at any rate, it's something that I myself had to try to deal with, and that's what this project's all about.
David Kopp teaches at the University of California at Davis. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation about theology and the animal rights movement. My guest is Andrew Lindsay of the Center for the Study of Theology at the University of Essex. Andrew Lindsay, welcome to Soundings. You are a theologian. You are also an advocate of animal rights. What in the world does theology have to do with the rights of animals?
I think it's wholly appropriate that you should ask that question, because the relationship between theology and animal rights has, certainly historically speaking, been almost entirely negative. I wouldn't want to overstate that, but there is a very positive tradition in Christianity about animals, but there's also a highly negative tradition. Animals are thought not to have mind or soul. They're not thought to have sentience. They're not thought to have rights. In consequence, many people don't think that the question of animals, that is, the question of the treatment of animals, is thought to be a moral issue at all. What we have in the Christian tradition, is not a situation whereby animals have been looked at as an issue and our answers given. We haven't looked at animals as an issue.
How have we looked upon them? Have we certainly haven't ignored them. They are there. They're around us spiritually, practically speaking. How have we ignored them?
Well, I think we do have to grapple with the fact that the largest Christian church in Christendom, the Roman Catholic community, does not regard animals as having any moral status. We have no direct duties to them. It was in the middle of the 19th century that Pope Pius IX forbade the opening of an animal protection office in Rome on the grounds that we had duties to other humans, but none to animals.
Was that necessarily a moral issue, or was it a political issue, a financial issue, that the church didn't want to spend money, want to put energy into a cause such as animal rights?
Well, it would certainly be true to say that Pope Pius IX, how should we put it, the slogans of the liberal camp or the slogans of the devil. Nevertheless, he had some very, very good theology on his side. St. Thomas Aquinas, you see, for example, the major Catholic theologian, didn't just hold that animals had no soul or no reason or no mind. He also held that some animals were agents of the devil. Mm-hmm. Now, you might say, what's the relevance of all this theology? Andrew, well, I'm afraid the relevance historically is very significant, at least for the animals, because from the 9th to the 19th century, what we have is no less than 200 written cases of animals being subject to criminal prosecution.
And burned as witches?
Criminal prosecution and capital punishment, the last one being in 1905. In other words, there is a strong negative tradition of vilifying animal life, of regarding animals as incarnations of the devil. I mean, actually, quite literally.
You make me think of, what is it, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, Esmeralda's little goat tapping out on the stones and being vilified by a religious figure as, what, possessed of the devil.
Sure. Well, just look at our language. The term animal, mm-hmm. beast, brute, bestial. The term animal itself is a libel on the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm. That there's a line I most dislike from the Book of Common Prayer in the marriage service. You may know it. It's from the rather old-fashioned one, which we don't use today, thank goodness. But it goes like this. It refers to brute beasts that hath no understanding, right. Which is really, from an animal rights point of view, a bit of a laugh for a number of reasons. Not least of all, the one that most mammals have more capacity, or at least show more capacity for monogamous relationships than most human beings.
Well, does that mean necessarily that they are moral? Are we talking here about morality, or are we talking about the biology of instinct?
Well, I think we have to be a bit careful when it comes to, well, at least I certainly have to be very careful when I come to biology. I used to say, you see, as everyone else used to say around me, that nature was red in tooth and claw. Mm-hmm. Now, biologists are very unhappy about me saying that, and so I don't say it. What we seem to have to say now is something like this, that within the created order, there are forces of harmony, what we might call forces of cooperation, even the possibility of some altruism at a rudimentary level, as we see it, of course, and also forces of non-cooperation. It's rather like debates about intelligence, you see. Okay. Until comparatively recently in the history of humankind, we've assumed the humans were the most intelligent and simply looked for the morphological evidence. Now, if I'm a little wary, even about what appears to be this outlandish issue as to whether animals are moral, it is simply because human beings are terribly good at prejudging the evidence. And so I'm not trying to prejudge the evidence. My argument actually is theological rather than naturalistic. But I'm happy to talk about how we need to keep our options open mm-hmm. in looking at what is actually happening with animals.
Well, let's talk about the theological evidence. Let's overlook the possibility that we're right or we're wrong about the moral nature of animals, yeah. because we really, for now, have no way to prove that.
Sure.
Let's get back again to our own nature and the way we treat animals. Why do you justify this theologically?
There are so many ways in theologically, but the one that personally impresses me the most is this one. Many people, as a kind of knee-jerk reaction, respond to the claims of animal rights by saying, ah, but look in the Bible. God gave us dominion.
Mm-hmm.
And they think this is the answer. You see, they think they found the answer.
And dominion is what? Is a loaded theological term?
Well, they interpret dominion quite simply as despotism. It means okay. simply being free morally to use the whole of creation as one wishes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's certainly true. without a doubt that most theologians have given up on this idea of dominion as despotism. It's problematical from a whole range of ways. For example, if you look at the first creation saga, man is made in the image of God, man is given dominion over the fish of the sea and the fowls of the air, and then, lo and behold, he's told to be a vegetarian, a diet definitely excludes meat. Yeah. In other words, it couldn't possibly mean dominion if we haven't even got the power of life and death over animals.
The killing and the eating of animals comes, what, after the fall, so to speak?
That's right, after the fall and the flood. But the crunch...
The flood or the fall? Which?
Both.
Both, okay. Both.
But for me, the most compelling argument theologically is if we begin to look at how we should exercise that dominion. Mm-hmm. You see, it's not just enough theologically, not sufficient theologically to say we have power. The question we have to ask is, how should that power be exercised? And what model, what example, what exemplar have we in exercising that power?
All right, well, let's pursue this line of reasoning, Andrew Lindsay. Suppose we stop killing chickens and cows and pigs and we start eating vegetables and fruits and nuts. Is the world going to be overrun by species of animals that we can't control? Will we need to exercise dominion? Where does this take us, this theology of animal rights?
Well, let me first button up my Christological argument, because I do think this is quite central.
Fair enough.
You see, if you look at the person of Jesus, he is supposed to be, according to Orthodox theology, the incarnation of God. Mm-hmm. He is the one who expresses. He is the one who is entirely one with the power of God. And how is the power of God expressed in Jesus Christ? In being a despot? In tyranny? Not so. He is the one who comes among us as one who is to serve. Mm-hmm. He is the one who washes the dirty feet of the world. He is the one who saves people from physical and mental oppression. He is the one who champions the poor.
He also ate meat and fish.
Well, I'm coming to that in a moment. In other words, he is the one who expresses the lordship of God in terms of service. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it seems to me that we cannot claim for ourselves a moral relationship with animals that is actually contrary to what we believe to be at the very heart of the moral relationships of the world, theologically.
All right, so you're going to ask us, Andrew Lindsay, to offset ourselves, not in terms necessarily of our natures. You're implying that it is possible for humankind, to treat animals with respect, with dignity, to impart to them a sense of morality and rights. You're asking us to forsake habit, not morality. Have I got this distinction right? Custom.
That's right.
I don't know what the term is.
I'm asking us to do two things. Firstly, I'm asking us to recognize that we're in a bit of a mess when it comes to animals, morally. Mm-hmm. I'm not a purist in the sense that there was a time when I was an avid fisher, an avid collector, an avid maker of animals captive. I used to enjoy eating them enormously. Mm-hmm. So I don't come to this discussion with any sense of personal purity. I have none. Indeed, I like the idea of Albert Schweitzer that a clean conscience is a figment of the imagination. So that's the first thing. I must say that I have no moral credentials in this debate. That's very important to say that, because I think we're all guilty. And I think we are all involved in the exploitation of animals. We hunt them, shoot them, fish them, ride them, wear them, trap them, factory farm, experiment upon millions. Now, none of us are free from guilt in the sense of being morally responsible. Now, that's the first thing we have to recognize. The second thing we have to recognize is that somehow we have to get out of this situation.
You're talking about a kind of an affirmative action policy.
Right.
With respect
on a massive world scale.
Let me ask you to pause for just a moment, Andrew Lindsay. Take me back to what you were calling your Christological argument. What about Jesus Christ? He ate fish, or is reputed to have eaten the flesh of animals. Do you find that a contradiction?
No, I don't. And perhaps I can try and explain why. There are two things I have to say. Firstly, my view is not the absolutist one, that we are never, ever justified in killing a living thing. I don't see how we could hold that. I couldn't hold that line because God has made us too clumsy a creature to be able to walk even down the street without the accidental hurting or harming of animals.
If I see a threat imminent, you're not going to contravene that.
Well, I mean, I have to say that I think there is a case for killing sentient beings, animal or human, in, for example, the case of mercy, a case, incidentally, when we may well be nicer to animals than we are to humans, in self-defense. If killing can be avoided, we ought to do so. Indeed, that's my rather minimal, modest, and moderate proposal to humankind, that we ought to desist from killing, from being a source of injury, which includes killing whenever we can. And so we have been given that moral choice. And I'm not saying this can all be realized in 5 minutes. We're all just too morally compromised for that to be. But my hope, my task, my intention is to try and encourage and inspire my fellow human beings to be involved in programs of personal disengagement from injury.
So this begins what? In the quiet of one's conscience and not with government policy.
Laws can't make us good. I mean, we know, we've learned that from the civil rights movement. Laws can't make us good. And laws are rather ineffective in changing people's hearts and souls, which is also what the animal rights movement is about. And can I just say this, because I think this is very, very important. I don't want to make people feel guilty. I spend my time as a chaplain, in part, trying to rescue people from the feelings of guilt that the church has created in them. So I certainly don't want to make anyone guilty. On the contrary, I want to inspire people, encourage people, that actually making peace with creation, living at peace with creation, is actually a possible goal. You see, my view is not the Christian churches ought to adopt animals as another issue on the secular agenda. My view is, look here, Christians, look at what your theology has said and begin to think it through. I do not see how theologically we can love God and hate his creatures.
Andrew Lindsay is the Director of Studies at the Center for the Study of Theology at the University of Essex. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 462. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about the teaching of biology and the theory of evolution. My guests will be Nicholas Rupke, a geologist and independent scholar from the Netherlands, and Carl Stock of the University of Alabama. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in August marks birthdays for Sir Alexander Fleming, the Scottish discoverer of penicillin, for Mata Hari, the Dutch dancer, courtesan, and spy, for Alfred, Lord Tennyson, the English poet laureate, and for Cecil B. DeMille, the American movie director. Sir Alexander Fleming was born during the second week in August, 1881, Mata Hari in 1876, Lord Tennyson in 1809, and Cecil B. DeMille in 1881. This week marks the anniversary of the first resignation by an American president. Richard Nixon stepped down under the threat of impeachment in early August 1974. Nearly 200 years earlier, in early August 1782, President George Washington ordered the creation of a badge of military merit that came to be known as the Purple Heart. Finally, this week marks an anniversary for the political independence of Bolivia, which gained its freedom from Spain during the second week in August 1825. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Skepticism, Morality, and Rights. Two conversations this week on Soundings. David Kopp, a philosopher from the University of California at Davis, talks about the relationship between skepticism and morality. Andrew Lindsay, a theologian at the University of Essex, discusses Christian theology and the animal rights movement. Skepticism, Morality, and Rights. This week on Soundings.